This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share down-to-earth advice, and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. All with some interesting research to go along with your calls. Zorba, what have we this time?
If you're a girl and you read diet articles, does that make you more prone to have anorexia or bulimia? We'll talk about some risk factors for those very important teenage diseases. And antidepressants, are they really linked with osteoporosis? Some interesting research that is controversial, to say the least.
Okay. And we have a listener-supplied recipe coming up.
African peanut soup. This is a wonderful recipe. Be for any of you who have never tried peanut soup, you've got to try this.
This one from Newton, Kansas listener Alina Entz, coming up in about 25 minutes or so. The toll-free number, if you'd like to talk with Zorba, 1-800-462-7413. Let me give it to you again, 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Maryville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Recently, I lost a significant amount of weight. A large portion of that due to that, I don't know, I'm assuming Zorba's probably heard of this. It's that that arcade game. It's called Dance Dance Revolution.
Yes,
it's actually a really good cardio exercise.
Yeah, it is a great cardio exercise. I'm looking at Tom right now, and he has the deer in the headlights look.
I don't have a clue.
Have a clue. Why don't you tell him what it's about?
Well, it's the game is called Dance Dance Revolution. It started out in Japan. It's gained a lot of headway here in America. When I first started playing the game, I think my weight maxed out at about 285 when I was about 6 feet. I'm down to like 170 now. I didn't lose at all to the game, but I did lose a very significant portion. I also did a little bit of dieting and some weight training.
So tell them what it looks like in the arcade. Explain what it looks like.
Well, I've never played it in the arcade. I played the home version,
but
in the arcade, it's this really really huge cabinet. It's got a huge screen. It's got a bunch of buttons, and on the floor is this dance pad that sort of has, you know, the cardinal directions up, down, left, and right, and as the music plays, arrows go up to the top of the screen, and you step on the corresponding arrow as it hits the top of the screen.
Right.
You know, it has light, standard, and heavy.
Oh, yeah. No, it is fabulous looking. It's really noisy, and people can play it together, and it's a fun thing. And now Tom is beginning to show signs of recognition.
Well, no. I mean, I've never heard of it before. You have a home version, which is on a DVD or a videotape or something?
Yeah. I play it on Xbox.
And then you watch that and you dance along to it.
Exactly.
And how long do you do that every day?
Oh, I don't do it anymore because my dance pad ended up breaking down on me.
Oh.
So in other words, you hit the dance pad and it was just too much because you were really doing it as an incredible workout. I take it.
So
it was. It's actually a fabulous cardio workout.
So what's your question for Zorba?
Well, my question is, after, like I said, I've lost about 110 pounds so far, but I've still got some stubborn, you know, surface fat that I can't seem to get rid of.
You know, the hard thing about dieting is that our bodies remove our fat stores from wherever our bodies decide they're going to remove the fat stores. And so it's often the fat beneath the skin that we want to get rid of. So, you know, because we're looking for muscle definition and we're looking for muscles that are more defined versus muscles that are more round. Now, if you take someone who, we'll say, is an elite athlete and has, we'll say, 3-5% body fat, they have very little fat in their entire body, around their organs and their belly and so on, and around their muscles and underneath the skin. And as a result, they have tremendous muscle definition. But as you put on weight, you put on fat wherever your body decides. Some people it's in the hips, some people it's in the belly. If it's in the belly, you're at a little more risk for cardiovascular disease, such as heart disease and so on. So there's no way to really pinpoint how you're going to remove that fat. The ultimate goal is the less you eat, the more weight you lose, the more fat you lose from anyone. But that's a problem that people often say. They'll say, hey, you know, I've still got fat around my middle, even though I'm losing it around my thighs, I want to lose it around my middle, and there's no magic way of doing it, although there are lots of gizmos out there that try to convince you of that. Continue to try to lose weight. That next 10 pounds that you lose will begin to take fat probably out of the surface, the subcutaneous fat, which is the fat beneath the skin that you're looking at, because if that will hide in at that weight, you're not going to have as much much fat on pork.
But 110-pound weight loss isn't based mainly on a video game.
It's diet and exercise, diet and exercise.
That's a great job. He did a wonderful job with that combination.
And you see these things, what happens is you see these in arcades. I know you don't go to a lot of arcades, but you see them. And you'll see two teenagers usually playing them together. And you can see them, they kind of show them in movies and so on. And it's interesting because I never thought of it as a workout that you could do at home on Xbox. But it really is a fun workout. And some people really enjoy dancing, makes them feel good. And we know that for many people, going in regular repetitive exercise is boring for them. So I think the idea of using this dance pad might be a new key to your exercise program, Tom. I can just see you dancing away in the morning. I'm doing my exercise routine.
You're not saying I need to lose weight.
No. But for your exercise, dance, don't stop.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. What's this research on girls who read these diet articles, Zorba, and the possibility of eating disorders?
Well, these are big issues. I'll give you a perfect example. Brazil, which I'm always reading about it now because my oldest son, Zach, is going to marry a young Brazilian woman. We've been down to Brazil a couple of times. Yeah. And the concept of female beauty in Brazil is different than female beauty in the U.S. It's more rounded. It's more curvy. Brazilian men like women who have a little more around the rump and around the buttocks. They don't like women who are a little bit higher around the breast. It's a different concept of beauty. Well, the Western, i.e. American, Western European concept of beauty is beginning to sort of come of age in Brazil. And as a result, they now have, for the first time almost ever, some of their earliest cases of anorexia and bulimia, which is very unusual there. Well, the issue in the U.S. is really whether or not diet articles, pictures of women dieting affect young girls. And this was an article in the Journal Pediatrics, looked at about 2,500 middle school students. So these are sort of early teen students, half were boys, roughly half were girls. About 14% of the boys read diet articles. So if you think the boys aren't thinking about dieting, that's certainly wrong.
What percent?
14%. So it's not zero. I would have guessed 5%, and the answer is no, it's
14%. Still pretty low, though, compared to the girls.
Well, the girls are 44%. Yeah. So nearly half the girls are thinking about dieting, and 14% of the boys are thinking about dieting. And also, what they've discovered is that the more if you had anorexia or bulimia, it was more likely that you were reading those articles. Now, there's no chicken and egg issue here of does one cause the other.
We don't have a good cause and effect on this.
No, but we know that society issues definitely affect anorexia and bulimia. All we have to do is look at cross-cultural studies like the studies in Brazil to see what they are. And if you look at magazine articles for teenagers, like in 17 magazine, a lot of the articles are about diet and how girls can diet and how they can lose weight. And we don't have a good handle on how to get a hold of this. It's clearly an issue that has to be addressed by physicians, by the schools, and by parents. And studies of teenagers over and over again have said even though they don't show parents the respect parents think they deserve, they still respect their parents for the most part. Teenagers still look to their parents for guidance no matter what. And if you're blank on it, you're not doing anything, you're not discussing it with your middle school teenage girl, and you're worried that she's not eating properly and she's at risk for anorexia, now is the time to talk about it. And especially if you see all the magazines that are around the house, and they're all diet, and every time you walk in a room, your teenager is reading about a diet, well, maybe it's time to talk about good eating.
What do you think about the fashion shows now starting to require minimum weights for the models?
I think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful idea. I think what happens is the fashion industry is basically run at one extreme, obviously not the obesity extreme, the fact that beauty should be anorexia. That's what the fashion industry has done. And they basically, if you look at Marilyn Monroe, when she was the symbol of beauty, by today's weight, she would be considered overweight. And if you look at fashion today, it's really Twiggy-like models, which started with Twiggy, back in the 60s. The fashion industry is a big leader with this. And this was in Spain, where they said they were not going to let women below a certain age on the runway. And, I mean, if they do that right away, they'll begin to make a change in these young girls.
Some in the industry say that you have to have skinny young women in order to show off the clothes properly. I think that's a lot of hogwash.
Well, you may think it's hogwash, but what sells in the fashion industry is certainly something that you have absolutely no idea about at all. So you may think
it's hogwash. You're questioning my expertise on the women's fashion industry.
You are an authority on Vogue and what sells Zorba. Down the runway time. You may be bright, but I don't think you have that chance in there.
800-462-7413. On to a listener now in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Zorba and Tom. Thank you so much for taking my call.
We appreciate the call. How can we help you?
I saw my gynecologist last weekend and talked to her about the fact that although I feel that for the most part I eat quite healthy and I do exercise roughly 3 to 5 times a week and stay active, I am not only having trouble maintaining my weight, but I'm gaining weight. I just cannot seem to drop a pound, and in fact, it seems to be ticking up. She shared a concept with me, and I just wondered your thoughts on this. And, you know, we've had my blood sugar tested. We know I am not diabetic, but she did intimate that I could be having some insulin resistance issues, and that may be something we want to take a look at, do greater testing for, and I don't think a blood sugar test can uncover that, and that perhaps through pharmaceuticals we might be able to keep that controlled. Is it possible to not be diabetic, but to have insulin-resistant issues that could be causing me to struggle so much with even maintaining my weight?
Well, if you look at insulin resistance, if you look at obesity, the heavier you are, the more insulin resistance you have. That's pretty much the case. So a third of the country of this country in the United States has insulin resistance, period. In other words, your body produces more insulin.
Well, now, what's the cause and effect here? Is the insulin resistance causing the weight gain, or is the weight gain causing the insulin resistance?
Well, the present theory is that the weight gain causes insulin resistance. And we know that when people begin to lose weight, they lose insulin resistance and their basal body insulin levels drop. So you can assume, what is your height and what is your weight?
Certainly, I am almost 5'9", and right now I weigh 167, and unfortunately that's about where I hover, having been always my whole life before I had kids at 140, you know,
right.
Tall and slender.
Right. The real issue is when you look at people and you actually measure what they're actually eating, you know, you have almost a camera, because people are notoriously, if they write down what they eat after they eat, they underestimate how much they eat. They overestimate how much they exercise by about 40%, and they underestimate how much they eat by about 40%. It's the 40-40 rule. So basically, if we look at it, it turns out that it's the small number of calories that make a big difference, and they're very hard to get rid of. They're the 150 calories a day, roughly, to 200 calories a day, drops your weight about 5 to 10 pounds a year. That's what it is. But it's hard to keep up that decrease in that calorie, the caloric content. So if you write down every single thing you eat really, really well, and you're obsessive for 3 days, you'll begin to see what your calories are. And the reality is, you're 200 to 300 calories too much every day.
Understood.
That's what it is, period. And it's, you go top speed for 30 minutes, that's about 400 calories. That's roughly what it is. But you can easily eat 400 calories in about 2 minutes of munching outside of the refrigerator. It's not so hard. Or you drink a nice big glass of milk, and you can easily get 200 calories in that, or high fructose corn syrup and so on. So you got to look at both sides of it. So you are insulin resistant, but there's no pill that will do that and drop your weight.
Understood. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Zorba, speaking of sugar, Barb from Norman, Oklahoma, left us a note on the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. Barb asks, could you tell me the difference between sugar and sugar alcohol? Foods that are sugar-free are often high in sugar alcohol. Is this good or bad?
Sugar alcohol just means it's a different metabolite of whatever happens to be within that particular food. And generally, it's going to be things that are often used to sort of sweeten the food without actually producing a high glucose load. So is it bad for you? No. Is it good for you? It's, once again, the number of calories that you're getting in. Sugar. A lot of sugar-free things are low-calorie foods, but some sugar-free things are not. And so basically, you never see sugar alcohol listed for the most part on any nutritional things, but you see them listed when you do a printout of what sugars are, and it's just a byproduct.
Does it add calories, sugar alcohol, I mean?
The answer is yes, it can add some calories, but it depends, once again, on how much is there. So is it good or bad? It's a function of how many calories are there. That's what it is. So once again,
but does it have as many calories as sugar?
Or? I can't tell you. I don't know the amount on weight, the difference between the number of calories of sugar and the number of calories.
So
of
if
sugar
we're
alcohol.
Concerned about counting calories, should we stay away from sugar alcohol
no.
if we can?
Calories. That's what it is. If you're concerned about calories, you're concerned about weight, you want to keep it simple and you want to simply look at calories.
Uh-huh.
That's really what counts. For a while, we thought that if you ate less fat, that you would be likely to become less fat. We know that isn't the case now. And, you know, the real issue with America is every 10 years, we eat about 50 calories more per meal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's ultimately where our weight comes from. Mm. So it doesn't matter where the calories come from. The calorie is a measure of energy. And when we don't use up that energy, we store it in the form of fat.
Mm-hmm. Want to talk with Zorba? Just give us a call. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Norman, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I'm calling because I broke my left ankle. About,
poor baby.
Yes. Awful thing. I missed the curb. And I heard them pop, and both of them pop. But the left one was really burning really bad. And I thought, gee whiz, why is my ankle burning so bad? And I got up, and I walked about 50 feet, and then I couldn't move.
Mm-hmm.
And my boss came and got me. I was on my way to work at 7 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So I've taken the choice between a hard cast and the boot. And I used the hard cast, and I was in the cast for 6 weeks. And I'm trying to get back into using my ankle and walking like I used to walk. And I don't know how soon that's going to happen, but that's the reason I called. I'm doing the exercise on my foot. I really can't afford to go to a physical therapist because that's like $120 a pop.
Uh-huh. Now, when did the boot come off?
It came off a couple of months ago.
About 8 weeks ago. That's a pretty good amount of time for that to come out. How's your pain? Do you have much pain at all?
Slight.
That's good. Not a lot of pain, just some slight pain. Let me tell you what the issue is and how you can do it on the cheap.
Okay.
The issue is muscle mass. When you're in a boot, when you're in a cast, you lose muscle mass right away. You start to lose it right away. You lose a lot within a week or 2 weeks. So losing muscle mass is what the issue is, and that's why you're more wobbly on your gait. And what you want to do is build up that muscle mass. And whether you go to physical therapy or do it yourself, ultimately that is your goal. An excellent thing for you to attack is an exercise bike. You either
I have one.
That's what you got to do. You got to do the exercise bike. Exercise bike is an excellent form of exercise. It's good for the ankle. It's not going to bother it. You got to hit it 20 minutes a day to 30 minutes a day. And if you do that literally 5 to 7 days a week, you'll build up the muscle mass and then you'll start to walk better. And that's all you have to do. You can do other things, but if you don't have pain, you really don't have to spend that money and go to physical therapy.
Mm-hmm.
We send people to PT when they have pain and stretching issues and they've got problems with range of motion.
Mm-hmm.
Your range of motion of your ankle is like it was before, a little bit stiffer. How would you describe it?
I can move the toes, and I can do what you call a semi-point, but not totally.
Okay.
And it's still swollen on the far left side.
And it's swollen a little. Aleve, two Aleve tablets twice a day, generic Aleve, just as good as the name brand, will help with the swelling.
Okay.
The ankle, working with the ankle in terms of using the exercise bike will help with the swelling. Wearing an elastic bandage or a neoprene sleeve that you pull up there. But hit the bike. You got one, hit it. 20 to 30 minutes a day, and what's going to happen is it's going to take 2 to 4 weeks to build up that muscle mass, and you will feel better.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Welcome.
I really appreciate that.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling.
You bet.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. Question for Zorba? Just give us a call. We have our recipe coming up next from Newton, Kansas listener Alina Entz for African peanut soup. Alina Entz was in West Africa and found this recipe and will be sharing it with you coming up next. More of your calls to our medical MythBuster and more research here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, if you'd like to talk with Zorba, here's the number to call, 800-462-7413. And we will be getting to the phones after our recipe. This one for African peanut soup.
Delicious.
Comes to us from Newton, Kansas listener Alina Entz, who joins us now on the phone. Alina, hi.
Hello.
Now, how'd you come up with this one?
Well, you know, I lived in West Africa for 4 years, and I loved peanuts as a main dish. And so when I saw this recipe, I just tweaked it to be similar. I liked it, and it's been a favorite ever since.
How long ago were you in West Africa?
Oh, 10 or 12 years ago.
I bet that was some experience, huh?
Oh, wonderful.
So what does your family think of your soup?
Yeah, they love it. When I make it, we can't quit eating it. It's just wonderful.
You can't quit eating it. This sounds like a wonderful, wonderful thing. I've had peanut soups when I've gone to specialty restaurants, but frankly, I've never made peanut soup at home, and this sounds like a dynamite one. So let's start out. We start out with 1 tablespoonful of olive oil.
As we go along with these ingredients, Alina, feel free to jump in if you want to elucidate.
Please.
That's a big tea of olive oil.
Which is great. 1 large onion.
A large onion.
Now, do you use red onions or white onions or a yellow onion, Bermuda onion? What do you tend to use?
Whatever you know, I use the onion that grows in my garden, and usually those are the yellow onions.
The onion that grows in your garden. Now, that's the segue to, do you have a big garden?
I do, yes.
You know, an onion is an onion is an onion.
No, it is not. It is not the case. Some are definitely spicier. Some are more than others. But, okay, 1 medium sweet potato, peeled and diced.
A medium sweet potato peeled and diced.
Now, do you grow sweet potatoes in your garden?
Yes, I do.
You like sweet potatoes.
I do. Yeah. In fact, I got a bumper crop this year, and that's why I was looking for recipes that called for sweet potatoes.
And, you know, we don't use sweet potatoes nearly as much as our ancestors did. In the U.S., it was a common dish that was used in the 1700s and 1800s. And we generally, I mean, a lot of people just use sweet potatoes during holiday times.
Sweet potato is a yam. It's a sweet potato.
Right. That's exactly
okay.
It. That's exactly it. And we won't have the yam sweet potato discussion every time we talk about it. The term of endearment, 2 cloves of garlic chopped.
2 cloves of garlic chopped.
Jalapeno pepper to taste. So you chop up jalapenos, you mean, or you use a jalapeno pepper?
Well, I chop the jalapeno and put it in also.
Okay, so you put in as much. If people don't want to have a lot of hot spice, I myself would prefer the hot spice.
Yeah, me too.
Then you wouldn't use it. Yeah. 8 cups of chicken broth.
8 cups of chicken broth.
And if you wanted to keep this as a vegetarian dish, of course you could use vegetarian broth, mm-hmm. which you can easily pick up at the store. Mm-hmm. 1 teaspoon of thyme.
Little tea, thyme.
1 teaspoon of cumin.
Little tea, cumin.
1 cup of uncooked rice. Now, do you use brown rice or white rice for that uncooked rice?
I choose to use brown rice, but you can use either.
Either one. Mm-hmm. Brown rice currently is going to have a little bit more substance to it than white rice. So what do they use in West Africa, more white rice or brown rice?
They use more white rice.
More white rice, because that's really typically, from a storage point of view, you know, we've sort of moved back into the brown rice movement, but in Africa, I've heard they use more white rice. 3 cups of salsa.
3 cups of salsa.
Now, yours, since you have a garden, I assume might be homemade salsa?
That is correct, it mm-hmm. is.
How much salsa do you put up?
Well, I can't even estimate
that.
That's
a lot. That's a lot of salsa.
Well, what do you use for your salsa?
Oh, tomatoes and peppers and onions and garlic and spices.
It sounds great.
I put my jalapenos in there.
It sounds great. It sounds great. So, you know what? I would assume that the type of salsa you use very clearly is going to affect this recipe. If
that's
you use
exactly
a fresh salsa, it's going to taste one way. If you use a pre-made salsa, if you use a salsa that's hot or medium. So choosing your salsa well is going to affect this.
Yeah. Now, we'll be sending this recipe to a lot of listeners. Since you make your own, I'm sure you won't mind the listeners who would like your salsa.
That's
you'd be
right,
happy to send
right,
them salsa, right?
Right? Yes. So, okay, let's go to the next one.
Two
cups of garbanzo beans drained and rinsed.
So these
are out of a can, I assume.
That's correct.
2 cups of garbanzo beans drained and rinsed.
Very important to drain them because, you know, they have they basically have a carbohydrate surface to them, and that's what that stickiness is around there. 1 cup of zucchinis diced and unpeeled. Unpeeled is important.
A cup of zucchinis diced and unpeeled. Now, why is that important?
Well, because it'll add more substance. It won't dissolve as much, I would assume, in the soup, you know, because it has the skin on it. And then 2/3 of a cup of natural peanut butter. So natural peanut butter. What do you, go to the your health food store? Where do you go?
That is correct. I want the kind that is 100 made from only peanuts. You know, it doesn't have the sweeteners and things like
Well,
that.
Well, you can get that in the regular grocery,
Absolutely.
You can.
That's right. That's right. And it says natural peanut butter. And, of course, you have to make sure you mix it up because the natural stuff separates
out. The oil on the top.
The oil tends to go on the top. Okay. In a large pot, heat the olive oil, saute the onion, sweet potato, garlic, and jalapeno until soft. That's about 5 minutes. Then add the chicken broth or veggie broth if you want to use that. Thyme, cumin, and rice, either brown or rice, again, depending on your taste. Boil and simmer until the rice is cooked. So if it's brown, it's going to be longer, about 40 minutes or so. If it's white, it's going to be shorter, you know, 10 to 15 minutes. And then add the salsa, beans, and zucchini and cook 10 minutes longer until the zucchini is tender. And then I can see this in a separate bowl. Mix the peanut butter with 1 cup of the hot broth and then back into the soup. And that's, I take it so that it doesn't clump up, and stir it until it's mixed together, and bon appetit. You can serve it, and it looks like an absolutely wonderful, wonderful recipe. It has a little bit of saturated fats from the peanuts in there. It's got, interestingly, 22% of the protein you need for your whole day. So a quarter of the protein that you need, about 10 to 12 grams of protein from a serving of this soup. So this is a high protein soup that sounds dynamite.
Sounds delicious.
Thank you so much for giving us this recipe.
Really. You're welcome.
Thank
you
so
much.
Thank you. I would really enjoy it if I got some of that homemade salsa, but I'll have to deal with whatever I have. I'm sure that a lot of our listeners are going to love to come to our website and get this.
Alina, thank you very much for sending us this winning recipe. She gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low Fat, Guilt Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low fat recipe to us at
zorba@wpr.org.
Now, for today's recipe, send a stamped self addressed business sized envelope to Zorba Pastor and Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706.
Or come to our website at zorbapastor.org. You can pull up this recipe, you can pull up other recipes, and you can sign up for the weekly podcast.
+1 800 462 7413, your toll-free number if you'd like to talk with Zorba. And a listener with us now, Zorba, in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What's up?
I was calling about my fiancé, actually. And he is, every morning, he's always sick. Like, he just feels very nauseous. He can't eat until, like, 11 o'clock. And if forced to eat, he gets very bad stomach aches and just feels horrible, horrible in the morning.
This is every morning of his life?
Yeah, every morning. There's never a morning that he feels up and ready to go and ready for breakfast or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
I was just wondering if there's anything.
Is he a heavy guy or a thin guy?
He's a very thin guy.
He's a very thin guy. Okay,
yeah.
Very thin. What is his height? What's his weight?
He's 6'3 and about 140.
We call that very thin.
This is your fiancé. Are you sure he's not just getting cold feet?
I hope not.
Tom, how can you possibly say that? So, you know, it's interesting. 5% of the population wants to gain weight. We don't think about that because it seems like 95% of the population wants to lose weight sometimes. And when you look at the people who want to gain weight, they're usually guys. They're not usually women, although there are a number of women who want to gain weight. And it's often guys who are younger who want to gain weight. One of the issues I'd immediately look at is whether or not he's got too much acid in his stomach at night. And what I would do is I would take Prilosec, P-R-I-L-O-S-E-C. It's an over-the-counter medication now that's dynamite. And I would take it at bedtime, 20 milligrams. That's all they come in with, the over-the-counter pills, and see what happens over a month period. A lot of times people have acid, and the acid sits in their stomach throughout the night. And when they wake up in the morning, they have sour stomach. They don't necessarily feel good. And that might be his issue. That would be the first thing that I would look at. The second thing I would look at is, when does he last eat during the day? Does he eat at night before he goes to sleep, or just at dinner time? What are the rest of his food habits are? He's your fiancé, so I take it you've studied this, right?
Got to
study your man before you marry him, right?
Exactly. And he definitely eats before he goes to bed. And he'll eat lots and lots at night. It's the time he eats the most. So
that might be it, though. It might be that he's eating a lot at night, the food is digested, he has extra acid in the stomach, and in the morning, that's just too much. So I would move that eating habit closer to 6 o'clock in the evening, 7 o'clock in the evening. And either I'd have nothing, or I'd have a little something at bedtime. That's all what I would have. Try that for a couple of weeks. So he takes the Prilosec at bedtime. He has a snack before he goes to sleep, but he pretty much has his big meal at 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. This will reduce his overall acid, if you will, the acid insult to his stomach, and this might do the trick. So I think I would try that.
That's great.
And,
thank you.
And by the way, you're going to have a great life with this skinny guy. Skinny guys make the best husbands.
Now, that advice
ask my
comes,
wife.
Ask my wife.
On second thought, don't ask my wife. Just take my word for it. Thanks
there
for calling.
There you go.
800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. On we go to Sumner, Illinois. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Well, I was wondering if Zorba knew about mangosteen. It comes in a liquid in a pill form. It's a fruit that's supposed to help with antioxidant health. And I heard about it about 2 months ago, and since then, I bought 3 bottles. It's for sale through one of these pyramid selling groups, but I did not buy from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought it through our regular pill and supplement company we get through, and I'm almost done with my second bottle. I wonder if there's any validity to that or not.
You know,
it's
interesting. Mangosteens are sort of the latest fad to hit America. But let
right.
me tell you about mangosteens. Have you ever eaten a mangosteen? If you haven't been to Hong Kong or Southeast Asia, you probably have never eaten a mangosteen. Have you ever had a mangosteen?
No, I haven't. They say it's really terrible to eat. It's
it
real
is
bitter.
Absolutely delicious.
Delicious.
It is the most delicious fruit I have ever tasted
really?
In my life. It tastes like custard. The inside of the fruit is white. They have these seeds that basically you have to not bite into because the seeds are bitter.
Okay.
So you sort of suck on these seeds. And Queen Victoria had heard so much about mangosteens that she said that she would give $1,000 for someone, this is in 1880, who could bring her a mangosteen to eat. And basically, because ice was a real issue going back and forth to India and Southeast Asia. And I don't know if she ever succeeded, but they are an absolutely delicious fruit. And once you've tasted a mangosteen, you always want to taste them again. They're wonderful. The fruit is not bitter at all. The fruit, properly done, as I said, is like
well,
a vanilla custard.
Why don't we
taste.
Have mangosteens all over the place then?
They must be very hard to grow around here. They're funny looking fruit.
Yeah, according to what I heard, they only grow in a certain tropical climate under ideal conditions.
Yeah, tropical fruit, but we don't see other tropical fruit. Jackfruit, you know, now we're starting to see star fruit. Mm-hmm. They're tropical fruits that no one has decided to try to, you know, grow in our area and make it, but we might see mangosteens. Kiwis are a tropical fruit that we get now, you know, that we essentially get in America. But getting back to the mangosteen juice, this is just, as you said, it's a pyramid scheme. So, you
right.
know, what happens is we'll make mangosteen juice because nobody's heard of mangosteens, and it's the secret of a long tropical life, and we'll sell it in America, and it's a fad. It'll
well,
come
like
and it'll go. So, you know, whether or not it has any benefit out of any other fruit, I've never read anything that shows that it has benefit. And the juice is really expensive. How much do you pay for a little container?
Well, like I say, I didn't buy it through the pyramid scheme. I brought through, you know, a different source.
And yeah, what'd it cost you?
For a 32-ounce, they normally sell it at like $35. I've got buy one, get two free, so I paid around $13 or $14
that's not bad.
For
that's
32
not bad.
Ounces.
So how do you feel now? What do you take? How much do you take every morning?
I take 1 ounce every morning. You're supposed to take an ounce in the morning, an ounce
uh-huh.
at night.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, sometimes I take an ounce at night also. Like I say, I'm just about to finish my second bottle.
I have a question now. So is the juice you're drinking sweet or bitter?
It's sweet. They mix it, both companies that I know of, they mix it with other juices.
Mm-hmm. Like they must be taking the juice of the seed.
Well, from what I understand, they use the whole fruit. They use the skin, the seeds, and all. They grind it up, mm-hmm. and they take the extract from that.
Yeah, they may eat the whole fruit. The outside of the fruit is sort of this pulpy red stuff, this bright red to violet
yeah.
stuff. As you can see, I'm very familiar with mangosteens. But I ask that because I have two patients in my office who have come in talking about mangosteen juice. So it's very clear that instead of colloidal minerals, now we have mangosteens. So.
Since I've been taking it, I've talked to a couple other people, and they say they've been curing sore shoulders. I talked to one guy that's been taking it for a year. He said his gray hair is turning black again.
Uh-huh. Well, if you get something to make gray hair turn black, let me tell you something. That's a $1 billion product. The big pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer and Merck are going to want to capitalize on it. As soon as somebody says it puts hair on your head for the bald and turns the hair black, beware. Buyer, beware.
Thanks a lot for calling. 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. Stick around. We have some research. We have our medical myth buster and more of your calls coming up here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Again, 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Before our next call, Zorba, you mentioned research on antidepressants and the possible risk of broken bones.
Right. Important research that was published in the Archives of Internal Medicine that looks at people who are taking antidepressants, and there's some important questions that are not really answered but are brought up by it. Basically, they were roughly about 5,000 people followed for a variety of medical problems. It was a longitudinal study. Some people were depressed. Some people were on antidepressants. Mm-hmm. They went back and looked and said, you know, which people who are on antidepressants were more likely to basically have fractures and have osteoporosis. And they found basically that the risk of osteoporosis was double for those on antidepressants.
Double.
And the risk of fractures basically also of having a broken bone from osteoporosis was also looked like it was double those who were on antidepressants.
This is all antidepressants?
Pretty much so. Most of the antidepressants were called the SSRIs. There's Zoloft, Prozac, Lexapro, the ones that are most commonly in use, Paxil. Those are the four biggies.
Well, this sounds like serious stuff.
Well, it's serious stuff. If it's real, it is serious stuff. Now, keep in mind, there's a chicken and egg issue. People who are depressed may not eat as much, may not exercise as much. They may not be as strong. They may be more likely to fall. Fractures are associated with osteoporosis. They're associated with dizziness. Antidepressants can cause dizziness. They're also associated with weakness. People who don't exercise as they get older are more likely to be weak. And, so we don't have a longitudinal study to look at it. But, yes, that's pretty significant. If it really is, if antidepressants cause bone thinning disease, that's a significant risk factor that ought to be weighed in. But this doesn't show it. It's not a double-blind study that's looking at that.
Oh, we don't have a control group.
No, and this is the whole issue that we had with estrogen. With estrogen, we knew that women who took estrogen had fewer heart attacks. And then when we did the double-blind study, we found out it must not be the estrogen because the women who took the estrogen had a slightly higher incidence of heart attacks and stroke. So there must have been something else in that estrogen-taking group that we didn't know. Maybe they were happier. Maybe they had more social relationships. Maybe they had more friends. Who knows? Well, and it may be the same with depressed people.
Is this a crackpot idea that people on antidepressants maybe ought to get a bone density study or find find out whether they have osteoporosis.
No, that is a great idea, and that may be the issue. The issue might be that if you're on an antidepressant, what you should do is be checked, and you're at the age group, get checked for osteoporosis. That's a really good idea because we don't know, we won't know until we have a good study whether or not it causes osteoporosis, but since it may be a risk factor, if you're at that age group and you've never had a densitometry test for your bone, why not get one and see if you're at risk for osteoporosis? And if so, then have a talk with your doctor and determine what your next step is.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. A listener now, Zorba, in Sussex, Wisconsin. Hi.
How you doing? I'm calling about a myth, your myth category. And as a semi-truck driver for the last 34 years, we have to take this DOT physical every 2 years, the Department of Transportation physical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the blood pressure category, they allow 140 over 90 as the tops. And over the years, I have heard about other semi-truck drivers. I've never done this myself, but they take vinegar to get the blood pressure down. And just taking a little bit, like maybe 2 tablespoons, and doing it 3 days straight and having real good numbers when they take physical. Now, is that a myth or is that...
It's a complete myth. Absolutely. 100%. You nailed it. You nailed the myth. But I'll tell you what isn't a myth and what the issue is. There are two issues. First of all, if you have high blood pressure, you need treatment. So if your blood pressure is really over 140, over 90, you need to be on pills. I mean, because we know that hypertension kills, causes stroke, causes heart attack. And if you're a trucker and you really have elevated blood pressure, you need to be on blood pressure pills. You don't need to be fooling around and trying to fake the numbers. But there's something called white coat hypertension, where you get anxious and you don't really have high blood pressure. It's a false elevation. It's a fake elevation because your pressure is elevated because you're anxious when you walk into the physical. The vinegar gives them such confidence that they are so relaxed that when they go in the room, when they go in there and they get their physical, their pressure is down. It's because they don't have white coat hypertension. They know the vinegar is going to help them. That's what it's working for. It's working if there's a white coat component of anxiety. The vinegar is treating the anxiety because they go, hey, man, I've got my vinegar. I'm not going to be worried.
Right.
And if their pressure is still elevated, they need treatment. That's what it means. I mean, that's what they're saying.
Right.
Yeah, you know, they have their own goofy rules. It's not as if you're at risk for heart attack and stroke that day for your physical, but they want to make sure you're on the right blood pressure pills because you're less likely to have a stroke, thereby causing harm on the road. That's the idea behind these physicals.
Right.
But so you don't take vinegar, huh, before you go in?
No, I've been on this Hyzaar medication for probably 25 years. It works for me, you know, and it keeps it right around 128 over 82.
That's your goal. The closer to 120 over 80 you are, the longer you live, the fewer heart attacks, the fewer strokes you'll have.
You know, every time you go in a doctor's office, no matter what the reason, you get your blood pressure taken these
days. That is correct, right.
I was in a doctor's office not long ago and said to the nurse, "Now, you treat me very nice and be very kind and gentle. I want my blood pressure to be down." Because that's what you're saying.
Right.
If you're in a good mood, maybe you get some nice music playing, your blood pressure is likely to be lower.
But the opposite is you're anxious. You're going in for your physical. Just picture it. You're going in for your physical. If your pressure is high, you don't get your license renewed until the pressure gets down.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden, does that mean you're not on the road? It's an anxiety-provoking thing.
Sure.
So, and one thing I think if truckers are worried about their blood pressure, get an automatic blood pressure cuff. Spend $50, get a good one. Get your blood pressure measured the right way or in a doctor's office. See if your blood pressure is measured the right way. See if you do have high blood pressure before your physical so that if it is, you can get it treated.
And if taking this vinegar puts you in a more relaxed mood.
By all means. A thimble full of vinegar makes the medicine go down. Absolutely.
Thanks a lot for the call at 800-462-7413. Zorba, time for our medical myth buster. Today's myth deals with that age-old adage that sitting up straight is not only proper etiquette, but good for your back. Is this true, or are generations of parents wrong when they say to us, sit up straight?
Well, luckily my mother is not living now, so she wouldn't cringe, but she would turn over in her grave because she'd always say, sit up straight, you're slouching, you're going to get a curve back.
Right.
And it turns out that is absolutely 100% a myth.
No kidding.
a myth. Sitting up straight,
even if you're a kid, when your back is not totally formed,
absolutely a myth. That is absolutely a myth. In fact, many years ago, a number of scientists looked at this. They inserted needles into the back of volunteers, measuring exactly what the pressure was like in the discs in a sitting position, in a reclining position. And it turns out that when you sit up straight with your back, you are putting more pressure on your intervertebral discs. In other words, the discs that are in between the basic spine, the spinous processes that are made of bone. You're putting more pressure on them when you're sitting up than when you're in a reclining position. Reclining position in a somewhat way, so you're reclining in a typical teenager reclining position, turns out to be the safest thing for your back.
Go away.
So sitting up straight
even,
is
a wait
myth.
A minute, now reclining.
Those Puritans were
wait
wrong.
Wait a minute. Now reclining doesn't necessarily mean slouching,
right.
though.
It does. Sitting up, I know you're shocked because your mother told you the same thing.
Yeah.
Sit up straight in your chair, it's better for your back, is wrong. It's wrong. It doesn't work.
Even a slouch in a straight chair.
Get in a comfortable position. That's what you do. Now, you may want to sit up a little straighter because you like the way it looks, or you may tell your kid, you ought to do it because I don't like the way you slouch because I think that's a bad habit and I just don't like it. But from a point of view of it's good for your back, Whatever's good for your back means you should be comfortable, and comfortable doesn't mean sitting up with your back straight. Like Miss Schutte used to tell me in class. I remember in fourth grade, Miss Schutte said, "Mr. Pastor, you're slouching. Sit up straight." Well, that was wrong, Miss Schutte was wrong. She was wrong about a lot of things. That's one of the things she was wrong
about. I've never said this before to you. I don't believe you.
That's because your mother was a very good teacher.
I know.
Believe your mom.
Here's what else.
That's okay.
What else
Go
do you
believe
always
your
say?
Mom.
What else do you always say? Believe your mom.
That's
you
right.
always
believe
say.
Believe your mom. That is true. Well, we're just going to leave it like that, Tom. Believe your mom or believe me.
Well, make sure then to slouch over that computer and send us an email with a myth you'd like Zorba to bust. Just send that email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. A listener now, Zorba in Albany, Georgia. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help you?
I have a sinus infection. I get it sometimes a couple times a year, and I'm a driver, truck driver. I don't have a chance just to go to any doctor. I don't have a family doctor of my own, which I should, but I don't because I travel a lot.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just wondering, is there something I can take to fight this infection without going to a doctor, getting an amoxicillin or whatever? Is there something organic that I can take?
Well, you bet. First of all, most sinus infections are viral, and our body fights them. Even though we go to the doctor, and the doctors often give us antibiotics because we're there, the fact is, you do the research, 95% of them are viral and do not need an antibiotic. And basically, an antibiotic is exerting its placebo effect, and there are some things. So, first question, do you smoke?
No.
Okay, that's important because if you smoke, you're at more risk for sinus infections. Second question is, let me give you some ideas. You get them how many times a year, and how long do they last?
2 to 3 times a year, and this one here I've had over 2 weeks now.
Okay, couple suggestions. First of all, because you're in your cab all the time, you're driving as a truck driver, you get a saline spray. They're called saltwater spray. They're non-prescription sprays. They're natural in that they're just like saltwater, and you moisturize your nose. That's the first thing. You get the spray. Your nose is a little stuffy. You spray this in your nose will feel better, and what it does is it loosens the secretions. That's part of the issue. The second thing you do is go to the drugstore or to a discount store and get a neti pot. They're called NETTI, neti pot. Now, they come under a variety of name brands, and basically it's a little pot that looks like an Aladdin's lamp, and you fill it with salt water, and they tell you how to do it. They make these little packets of salt water you can take with you on the road, and every morning, once or twice a day, you sort of clean out the back of your nose by putting this little pot of salt water, and you learn how to do it, and it's really good because it gets rid of the tough mucus that's in the back of the room and allows for drainage.
In the back of the room?
I'm sorry. In the back of the nose. gets rid of the tough mucus in the back of the nose that is responsible for decreasing that drainage. And the final thing is, if that fails, there's steroid sprays. You do need a doctor's prescription, and they open up the sinuses even more. And they're a prescription drug, and you can get one with a refillable prescription. So when you've got a sinus inflammation, you just open up the nose a bit with these steroid sprays. But short of going for the steroid sprays to the doctor, you don't need an antibiotic 95% of the time. Saline spray, the neti pot, you can do it a lot just with those two things. And also a little vitamin C, 500 milligrams twice a day, that might help too.
Yeah. For this sort of thing, staying away from the doctor isn't a bad idea.
It's actually a good idea, because you go to the doctor, you're going to get an antibiotic 70-80% of the time. So the answer is staying away from a doctor, in this case, is better.
Yep. Thanks so much for the call. Time, Zorba, for a quick question from our Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This one comes to us from Karen in Michigan, who writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba and Tom, please advise me on the purchase of a bathroom scale. Are certain models or styles more accurate than others? Is there any advantage to analog or digital? My husband thinks the waist-high balance-style scales that doctors have in their office are the most accurate, but they are so big."
They are so big. They're enormous. Well, it turns out that they are the standard of the industry are waist-high scales. But the fact is, you can buy some very good electronic scales that are expensive. They cost $100 or $125, and they are standardized. And they are very, very good, and they work much better than the pure spring scales. The pure spring scales have a problem in that they're not nearly as accurate. But if you're looking for your own weight and the differential of your weight, you know, let's say you weigh 145 on the spring scale and you're down to 140 on the same scale, that's going to be pretty accurate. That's going to be within a pound or two of what the real weight is. But the electronic scales that you spend over $100 for are remarkably accurate these days. You plug it in, they zero out, because that's part of the issue with the scale is, when do they zero out? They plug it in. And if you want to check your scale, what you do is you buy a 10 or 20 pound weight, a standard weight. And periodically, you know, you get on the scale, measure yourself, hold the weight, and if it's a 10 pound weight, you ought to be 10 pounds heavier. And if that's the case, those electronic scales are pretty much in sync then.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you want to weigh in on our discussion or just have a tip for our listeners, send an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, see you next time.
Thank you, Tom, and stay well.
For a copy of this week's recipe and all things Zorba, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
And don't forget, our producer is available anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For a copy of today's show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0203Z. To buy Zorba's book, The Longevity Code, your personal prescription for a longer, sweeter life, or to pick up a copy of Zorba's Heart Healthy Cookbook, just go to our website at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.